Morning. We have on our docket today 12AP 580, Russell Adams versus Northland Equipment Company, Inc. And Mr. Greenwald, Thomas Greenwald, is at the podium representing Russell Adams. Counsel, you've got 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Thomas Greenwald. Appreciate being able to present oral arguments today to you on behalf of my client, Russell Adams, who is also present here today. What happened in this matter is that Russell Adams did not want to accept the settlement proposal, but he was either compelled to accept that settlement proposal or his case, his claim, his common law claim, the tortfeasor who caused injury to him, would be dismissed. And he refused to accept the settlement, and his case was dismissed. The court, in considering these issues, must consider, before it creates new rights to the employer workers' compensation insurance carrier, to compel the employee to accept a settlement, which is supposed to be by agreement, and not forced.
Let me just clarify what you just said. Was the $200,000 ever paid?
$200,000 was paid to the clerk of the circuit court.
Okay.
He has not been paid $200,000. He has not received any of that money.
It hasn't been distributed under the formula in 10229?
There was never a hearing on the distribution of that $200,000.
So it's just sitting there?
It's just sitting in the clerk of circuit court's office.
Getting
the order
interest.
Provided that
drawing interest.
Has it been
invested someplace to draw interest?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Has it been invested someplace to draw interest?
Not that I'm aware of. It's under the control of the clerk of the circuit court for Rock County.
Okay. Thank you.
The order provided that if the defendants deposited that money with the clerk of circuit court, then the action would be dismissed.
Okay.
So that's how it went down. But there's been no order of distribution, et cetera. The policy considerations that this court should look at is that the court, if it allows the order to stand, will be permitting the act of making a claim for workers' compensation benefits to affect the right of the injured employee to pursue his or her common law claim, in opposition to a contrary principle declared by the legislature no more than 82 years ago, a declaration which has never been altered by the legislature, notwithstanding other significant changes to the Workers' Compensation Act over the last 82 years. That declaration is the very first sentence of 102.29. The making of a claim for compensation against an employer or compensation insurer for injury or death shall not affect the right of the employee to make claim or maintain an action in tort against any other party. Clearly here, that is not the case. His claim to pursue his common law cause of action has been denied. Denied on the basis of the decision in Delka versus American Family Insurance Company saying that he's waived by making a claim for benefits the right to pursue his common law claim if the court decides otherwise, and not based upon a ruling that he is unable to present evidence that would entitle him to go to jury, but simply because Judge Welker said, I don't think you can prove your case.
Counsel, you indicate he was deprived of the opportunity to have a hearing to present evidence. You make reference somewhere in your brief to a Rhines hearing. What kind of hearing are you anticipating or requesting, and what would be the issues of the hearing, the standard to be applied? So give me the contours of the nature of the hearing that you would be envisioning in this or in other cases?
Assuming that an injured plaintiff is held by this court can be compelled to accept the settlement he otherwise or she otherwise would not accept. The hearing that I would suggest is that, number one, simply be for the to be told what is the basis of the workman's compensation carrier or employer claim that this case ought to be settled, that the settlement proposed by the third party should be accepted. What is the basis for that? And then number two is he should be allowed to, the employer's compensation carrier should be required to put on some type of evidence as to that, not simply make a statement, but put on some type of evidence to demonstrate to the court who has to make a finding of what their evidence should suggest. Where's the weakness?
If he went to trial, what would he gain, assuming things came out the way he would like them to come out? What would he get?
What is the conclusion that I would like in this case? The conclusion that I would like in this case is the court to declare that my client cannot be compelled to accept.
That I understand. But what I'm asking you is, was there a $148,000 settlement or payment that was to be made to him?
$200,000 settlement.
Okay, but I thought $148,000 came in at some point.
The offer of settlement was $200,000.
All right. And he was going to get all of the 200?
With less than $30,000 or about $30,000, the comp carrier would end up with almost $68,000, more than twice as much.
I thought that the league had paid over $148,000 in workers' compensation benefits to Adams at the time of the motion. No?
I can't tell you exactly, Smith.
And then $200 was deposited with the clerk, yes?
The offer was $200,000.
Okay, but at the time of the motion, was $148,000 paid over in workers' comp to Adams?
The compensation benefits paid to that date were in excess of $150,000.
And then $200,000, is it more, was on
$200,000
at the clerk's
was
court?
Being paid from that. Okay, attorney's fees come out. From that, cost advance come out. That would leave an approximate adjusted gross of $93,000.
Let me try to make it I need it simpler in my mind. When someone has a workers' comp claim, part of the logic is to pay them right away or to get them relief right away rather than making them wait years and go through a lawsuit and endure all the things that could or couldn't happen during the course of a lawsuit, right?
No, that's not correct. Okay. Only certain benefits are paid right away, supposedly. Medical bills, supposedly, unless there's a contest. In this case, there actually happens to be a contest on some of the medical expenses. Okay. Another thing that may be paid are two-thirds of the average weekly wage for a limited period of time while he's totally disabled. If he's not temporarily totally disabled, he's entitled to even less.
I mean, a lot of times
He's not entitled to recover anywhere near those rights that he's entitled to recover from the tortfeasor. He's not receiving anything for pain and suffering. He's not receiving anything for the loss of the ability to enjoy the everyday activities of life. He's sitting there suffering and not getting anything for that. He's not getting paid anything for his real loss of income. It's only a discounted amount that he's getting paid for loss of income.
So is it your view that you get both workers' comp case injuries, or damages rather, and you can also independently bring a lawsuit to recover all those other kinds of damages?
Workman's compensation pays very limited
benefits. I understand that.
As compared to what he's entitled to under the common law claim.
Okay, so he gets both, is what you're saying. I'm just trying to figure out your argument and how it works in the real world. So he gets both. This is his claim, and it always has been, always will be. It's his claim, and he should be able to call the shots as far as you're concerned, right?
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh.
The employer does have certain rights.
Okay.
To pursue a claim to recover the amount that it paid back.
Paid back to who?
But what I'm saying is that the employee is the only one that has the common law claim. The claim of the employer is a statutory claim permitted by the statute.
So I'm back to my original question. What does he get that he didn't get through his common law claim? What claim remains his? What would he get if you went to trial and you got everything that you're asking for?
What did he get under
what would he get if you went to trial and he got everything you are asking for? What's your number that he's missing because they're forcing him to settle?
Well, instead of $31,000, he'd be entitled, in my opinion, as to the value of the case, multiple millions of dollars.
Okay.
And the kinds of damages he would get, including pain and suffering and full wage loss.
Pain and suffering, full loss of earnings, full medical expenses, the reasonable cost of the medical expenses, the loss of the enjoyment of everyday activities of life. And we're talking about pain and suffering for the rest of his life. This is a permanent injury. This is a spinal cord case.
He has a permanent injury?
Yes, spinal cord injury.
Okay.
Yeah, permanent injury. With a permanent loss of earning capacity, past and future?
Of course, all of that is subject to the statutory 10229 distribution formula, right?
Right.
The recovery is subject to the 102.29 distribution formula, correct.
So what's that mean? Explain that to me. Help me through this.
Well, okay. Under
102.29. Just make it easy. You know, pick a number and say who gets what.
Let's say there's a $3 million recovery. Just as an example. Let's say there's a $3 million recovery. And let's say that the workers' compensation benefits that were paid up through that time were $150,000. Attorneys, and let's say attorney's fees are $1 million. That comes off the top. Attorney's fees and expenses comes off the top,
that's
too.
That's whose attorney fees? The
and
employees?
Let's say the expenses, in this case, excuse me?
Those are the employees' attorney fees?
The attorney's fees on the recovery for $3 million.
I know.
Yeah, but
are they
whose claim? The employer or employee is the chief?
The court will determine the split on attorney's fees.
Okay.
Under the statute.
But there's $1 million. Okay.
$1 million for fees. Okay.
So we're
going to
take that off the top.
Take that off the top. Expenses after trial, $100,000. In this case, the expenses cost advanced at this stage before trial were over $40,000. I think that reasonably it could be expected that expenses with experts and all the experts that have been
required. Okay, let's make it $100,000 just to keep the numbers. So now we're down to 1.9, right?
Okay. Now we're at $1,900,000.
Okay.
Okay. From that amount of money, the compensation carriers paid back its full amount. And let's say they had paid in all benefits to that date $150,000. So then what is remaining is $1,750,000, which would then
go to maybe employee.
Maybe a little different.
I'm sorry. I made a mistake. There's a one-third guarantee before the comp carrier or employer gets anything. So out of the 1.75, one-third of that comes off, and that goes to Mr. Adams. Then the next $150,000 goes to the workers' compensation insurance carrier.
So really then
the balance goes to the injured employee, Mr. Adams.
So really they just step into the shoes like a subrogated party, right?
The compensation carrier employer is not subrogated. The law is clear. They do not have any rights of subrogation. They have rights only as stated by the statute.
Case law has indicated it's a derivative claim, though, doesn't it?
So what?
Case law it's indicated it's a derivative claim. It's not a subrogation claim. It's not an assignment, but it's a derivative
it's
claim.
It's a new claim allowed by the statute is what the court in Bergen versus Staples clearly enunciated. It is not a subrogation claim. In fact, they discussed the cases holding that a workers' compensation insurance carrier or the employer is not entitled to subrogation.
Mr. Greenwald, did you have a conflict of experts in regard to liability here?
Yes, quite a few experts. And I had an engineering expert who would be testifying at the trial that the plow was, when it was altered, it was inappropriately altered. It created an unreasonable risk of harm to users of the plow. The defense was going to raise the question of seatbelt defense, and I have and still have an expert testify rebuttal that the lack of wearing a seatbelt did not cause or contribute to cause the injury.
Judge Welker was looking at what to do in this case, he had heard previously a motion for summary judgment. Is that right?
Yes, he had.
So he was somewhat aware of the liability issues that were being faced here on both sides.
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The summary judgment does not apprise the court of what may or could be the testimony presented at trial. I have a quote from the Dahl case. Find it here.
But were there affidavits
but
filed?
What summary judgment, and here's a quote. Judge Welker determined that the plaintiff would not likely be able to prove his case at the trial. This decision was based upon his determination what could or might be proven at trial. But that is not the role of summary judgment. As this court said in Dahl versus Curran, which is cited in my brief, 16 Wisconsin 2nd 200, quote, on motion for summary judgment, the court does not determine what could or might be proven at trial, but whether, comma, on the record, comma, there ought to be a trier by the trier of facts. That's what summary judgment does. That's one of the real injustices in this case. We never got to present in any fashion what we could or might be able to prove at trial. Never allowed to do that. Because all the judge wanted to hear was nothing. He didn't want to hear anything further. He said, I heard summary judgment motions. I know I can decide this case on the basis of summary judgment. But that wasn't the purpose. That's not the purpose of summary judgment.
But was the motion hearing giving you any opportunity to spell out your position in regard to liability and damages?
No, sir. The judge questioned us about where we were on settlement, and then he said, I don't think you can prove your case, Mr. Greenwald, and I'm going to base my decision on the summary judgment, and I don't want to hear anything else. I then asked, I have filed a written request for a hearing and to be able to present evidence, to be able to cross-examine witnesses, etc., which is in the record. But I said this at the end of the hearing, towards the end of the hearing. Your Honor, I would ask the opportunity to present live witnesses. You've not given us that opportunity. And Judge Welker said, Mr. Greenwald, I don't believe that's necessary. And finished the hearing. I mean, we were not given the opportunity to present any argument, any proof of what we could or might prove at trial. And if this decision of Judge Welker is supposed to be based upon whether or not he thinks we can win at trial based upon the evidence we introduced at the trial, he never even let us put that in. I mean, understand that a trial judge has some opportunity to try to resolve differences. If there's a dispute, but you ought to be able to present evidence in opposition to the other side's position where there's a dispute. We weren't allowed to put anything in. That is one of the greatest injustices in this case.
Let's see.
Yes, Judge Prosser.
Counsel, as I understand the law, which is completely new to me, obviously the plaintiff here has an interest, but the insurer who paid workers' compensation claims also has an interest. And when a settlement was offered, I think the League of Municipalities Insurance Company expected to get, what, $75,000 to $80,000. Is that right?
Approximately.
Okay. So from the point of view of that insurer, that's $75,000 to $80,000 in hand and much less than $150,000 that you talked about. Okay. So, in effect, if you want to go forward, the workers' compensation carrier is saying, you're playing with my $75,000. Do you feel so confident in your case that you could pay them off ahead of time?
Pay them off ahead of time?
Just
give us
our $75,000, $80,000. You can have the whole case. You go right ahead and go forward. It's in effect substitute the money we're going to get that we have in hand.
But could we have negotiated on something with respect to that? That's not the issue because we weren't able to negotiate a resolution between the workers' compensation carrier's position and our position.
Okay, but
we were not able to reach a resolution.
The case is here now. What do we do with the case?
We do with the case is what we hold that my client cannot be compelled to accept the settlement that was negotiated between the tortfeasor and the workman's compensation carrier.
Okay.
Where they'd get almost half of their loss,
so if
and
you
my
don't,
client would get 10% of his loss.
Should we say, okay, if you get $3 million recovery, everybody's happy. But if you get nothing, well, that's just tough for the workers' compensation carrier.
That's the nature of a settlement. But a settlement also, the real nature of a settlement is that all of the parties to that settlement have agreed to have the issues resolved outside of the assistance of the law, outside the assistance of the court, outside the assistance of a jury trial. And that didn't happen here. And is that fair? I do believe it's fair. The question is one that inquires whether it is fair that the workers' compensation carrier is allowed to exercise its limited rights against a third party, of which it has none, absent the statute, and not be granted more rights not mentioned in the statute, i.e., the right to compel a settlement.
I'd like to stay with the law.
Yes.
I want to stay with your first issue and the law. So give me your legal argument. The first issue is whether or not a trial court can compel an injured employee who has accepted workers' comp benefits, can compel settlement against the injured employee's consent. You say the trial court or the circuit court doesn't have authority or isn't authorized to do that. Tell me your legal argument. Why not?
Well, there's multiple legal arguments. But number one, you begin with the statute that says your right to pursue your common law claim is not affected because you filed the Workers' Compensation Act.
Okay. And what is that right?
That right is to pursue your common law claim against a tortfeasor to recover your damages.
Now, why do you say it's a common law claim?
This is a tort claim for the recovery of damages that were suffered because of the negligence of a person or party or entity.
Is it your position that that common law claim carries with it the right to trial by jury in Wisconsin?
Yes, yes.
Why don't you get to that issue?
We have a constitutional provision that says that number one, we have a right to a remedy. If we are basing our remedy upon a common law claim.
Okay, I asked you about your right to trial by jury.
Yeah, number two, Article 5, Article 1, Section 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution states that a person has a constitutional right to resolve their common law claims by a jury trial. And the law is clear that if that common law claim existed at the time that the action accrued, and I cite the Eiger case, which says you therefore have that right to a trial by jury. Of course, there's conditions on it. If you don't prove your case, you don't have the evidence against the tortfeasor, it doesn't go to a jury. But if you, as in this case, the Judge Welker found, we had sufficient evidence to go to the jury. So the jury is the one that ought to, and we have that constitutional right to pursue that.
What downside is there ever for an employee to want to pursue their claim further? They've got a certain amount of money that they know they're getting, and the only person that could be out would be the insurer. I'm not understanding why an employee wouldn't always want to drive the bus on this one and say, hey, let's go to trial, because I've already got my money. I'm not going to get less than this. And the only thing that could happen to me is I could get more. And the only party that could be out would be the insurer. Why wouldn't an employee always want to do that? It makes sense. I would. Wouldn't you?
Well, you accept or reject settlements based upon what you and your attorney.
I understand that.
What might be reasonable.
But what would ever be the downside of rolling the dice? I mean, if you get a huge settlement offer, that's one thing. But if you don't, you already or does the employee pay back the amount that they were paid?
Well, the downside of rolling the dice is that you're rejecting one in the bush to get hand to get two in the bush.
I suggest that you not understanding.
But that's a choice.
You're not understanding the question, if I understand it. The question is, hey, the employee has nothing to lose by filing a complaint against the third party for product liability. And I think your answer should be, yeah, they have attorney fees and costs. The assumption of the question is that the employee going to have a contingent fee agreement and not be liable for any of the costs. Therefore, the employee is not out anything. Only the employee's lawyer will be out something. Therefore, the employee has nothing to lose by suing. I mean, I think that's the assumption of the question. That was the assumption of the question asked of you by Justice Prosser.
Well, the employee has that right under common law.
I understand that. But what does the employee have to lose if the employee goes ahead with its lawsuit?
He's at risk for losing everything.
No. He keeps his doesn't he keep his $150,000 that he got from workers' comp?
Only the limited recovery of workman's comp.
I know. I understand that. I think your answer has to be that the assumption is that he'll never be liable for costs. It's not true. And the assumption is that all the attorney fees are always contingent, and that may or may not be true. And the assumption is you can always sue, which may not be true because lawyers don't accept cases in which the chances of recovery are zero.
Well, take out the workman's compensation element of it, let's say an employee has a disability policy. So he's been getting something under the disability policy. Okay? And the disability carrier may have a segregation claim. But the point is, the employee is losing a right that's been granted to him since the days of the Magna Carta. In this instance, our client would receive about $31,000 out of a loss where we had expert testimony that his special damages were in excess of $2 million. So he has nothing to lose. He certainly does have a great deal to lose. And he certainly lost a lot because he was compelled to accept a settlement which implies an agreement which he didn't agree to.
So your answer...
Time is up.
Okay, counsel.
Any other questions? Thank you, Justices.
Mr. Greenwald, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Excuse me?
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
James M. Ryan, representing a Northland Equipment Company et al.
May it please the court, my name is Attorney James Ryan. I'm representing Northland Equipment and its carrier, Cincinnati Insurance Company. To my left is my colleague, Dustin Wall, who is very involved in writing the briefs. Counsel, I have my little speech ready to go, but I thought I'd address some questions that the court has put to counsel, first of all, since I am the respondent. The thing we have to understand as far as what the employee is going to get is the way I've looked at the distribution section of the statute forever is it's a third, a third, a third, because a third is usually the contingency fee.
Counselor, you know what interests me? I can read the statute, and I don't think what the employee gets is what this case turns on. But what interests me that no one talks about, it seems to me the tortfeasor's insurance company is getting perhaps quite a windfall in this case, because that's where the money's coming from that you want to accept as the settlement, correct?
It's coming from the insurance company. That's
the tortfeasor's insurance company.
The alleged tortfeasor's insurance company.
Right. Okay. Right. And they're not appearing before us today.
I'm representing Cincinnati Insurance.
That's a workers' compensation carrier, correct?
No, ma'am.
That is the insurance carrier for the tortfeasor?
It is.
Okay. All right. I didn't understand that. So that you represent the tortfeasor's insurance company, and you also represent the employer of Mr. Adams?
No, ma'am. No, Justice Rogensack. I represent Northland Equipment Company.
Okay. Wasn't that the...
No, the employer is the Village of Fontana.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, I knew that. Okay, and so Northland Equipment is the one that fixed the snowplow and made the springs too tight, according to the allegations that are made.
According
here.
To the allegations.
Okay, all right.
And so manufactured it?
They are supposedly the tortfeasor in this action.
Right.
And then Cincinnati Insurance is the insurer. Of the tortfeasor.
Right. Correct.
Okay. All right. I got it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Right. The attorney for the village is right there, Mr. Delory, who apparently agrees with our arguments and is allowing me to make them anyway. I also, of course, my clients have an interest. We paid the $200,000 and we want the settlement to be final. So I want to get to a couple of questions with regard to what the employee has to lose. Like I was saying, it's a third, a third, a third. A third for collection, that's usually with contingency, plus whatever the cost would be. A third then to the employee. The rest goes to the workers' compensation carrier to pay for the carrier's, up to the point of the carrier's lien. Now, what happens to any remainder after that if counsel is correct and he gets millions of dollars? What happens is that the rest of it, whatever is paid after the compensation carrier is compensated, acts as a cushion for any future claims of workman's compensation. Now, in this case, if his claims are correct that they're permanent and that there's going to be vocational retraining, future medical expenses, perhaps additional payments via PPD or TTD, temporary total or permanent partial disability, all of that comes from whatever the employee receives. And this is what I argued to the court. In effect, the employee, just to answer that question, has a chance to actually gain very little because he's already guaranteed a great deal from the compensation
carrier. Was the workers' compensation carrier represented by counsel as you proceeded?
Yes. Yes. Attorney DeLore.
Thank you.
So, I wanted to make that very clear with regard to the cushion. And that's what I argued in front of Judge Welker. You know, one of the reasons this should possibly be accepted is that the amount that not only that there's very little chance, in my opinion, and Judge Welker's opinion as well, that they would succeed on liability.
Just to finish this, and the workers' compensation carrier agreed with the settlement.
I'm sorry.
The workers' compensation carrier agreed with the settlement.
Yeah, not only agreed, they're the ones that asked
proposed it.
For it okay. to be settled.
All right. So, in effect, we have the workers' comp carrier wants to settle and get as much as it can with certainty.
Yes,
and Northland wants to settle because it's the alleged tortfeasor and it's getting out with certainty.
Yes.
And the employee does not want to settle because it thinks it can get more by pursuing its tort claim. That's the way we're set up in this case, right? Okay.
Counsel, and from your comment, it seems to me you are advancing the argument, as you advanced before Judge Welker, that in this case, given the nature and extent of injuries, which apparently are pretty extensive, that's the impression that I get. In fact, I can't remember if you said you might be paying five or seven times more than you've already paid. You talked about voc rehab. You talked about permanent partial disability. You gave a number. I can't remember if it was five or seven more. So there's, in terms of actual payments on this case, that may be lots of payments in the future for the workers' comp carrier. So your point, as I understand your argument, almost in response to Justice Ziegler's question is, hey, in this case, because of the severity of the injuries and the continued obligation of the workers' comp carrier to pay, including voc rehab and retraining and all that sort of stuff, that there will be a substantial cushion that will inure to the benefit, ultimately, if they got a big award, that will inure, you are saying, to the benefit of the workers' comp carrier because of the cushion and really not to the employee. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Except you forget the one-third part. In other words, if, let's say it came in at $1 million. I like easy figures. So after the reasonable cost of the claim, the attorney's fees and costs, then the injured worker would get one-third. Now, none of that inures to the benefit. It's just the cushion that inures to the benefit. And here, because of the rather severe injury, apparently, I mean, at least from this record that I could see, that the cushion might very well be eaten up even in a large award or settlement.
That's correct. And they would get the third. That's correct. You're right. So it's a third to the for cost of collections plus out of pocket for the attorney, a third to the employee, and then the rest goes to the comp carrier until that's paid, and then any amount after the comp carrier is paid is a cushion against what would be any future workers' compensation.
Where's the cushion stay? With
pardon,
the
pardon me?
Where does the cushion stay?
Oh, who has possession of the cushion?
Right.
It's my understanding that the employee has possession of the cushion. Although there was some debate about that at the hearing from Attorney DeLore, but my understanding is, from talking to the folks at my law firm who do the work comp, they say, no, as far as they're concerned, it stays with the employee.
So if, let's just say it's $3 million instead.
Sure.
If roughly a third goes for attorney's fees and costs, right? A third then goes to the employee, so that's $1 million, right?
Sure.
These are rough. And then a third would go to pay off the $150 that was paid by the insurance company, right?
Yes.
For the workers' comp. And then the remaining amount, the $850 or whatever, would is the cushion we're talking about,
correct.
Right?
That's correct.
And you think that cushion tags on top of the $1 million that the employee already got in the lawsuit?
I believe it's paid to, that's what the people at my firm told me. That's my understanding.
Counsel,
I don't really know.
Doesn't the statute say any balance remaining after the reimbursement described in sub 2 shall be paid to the employee or the employee's personal representative? And the statute says that.
That's right. That's what the statute says, and that's where they got it from. And I heard something else during the hearing, and that's why I just checked in preparation for this. But that's my understanding.
So if the employee drives the bus, why wouldn't they always want to go ahead? I mean, this is really an argument over who controls settlement. I think the settlement bus. then who? Why wouldn't you want to go forward as an employee? You've got your $150, and you have a chance at $3 million.
Well, I agree with what counsel I think was getting at. There's somebody's got to pay out those costs, and I think for if you're looking at just an omnibus situation. Some attorneys are going to be, I could get the seatbelt expert, I could get this expert from Georgia, I could, you know, et cetera, this person from Harvard. And it's just too much. And that's why they don't always go forward. But, you know, you go forward when you judge a case to determine whether the amount that you're receiving is, you know, getting pretty close to the amount that you will likely receive diminished by the chance that you have of getting nothing, of losing on liability.
You just did a great job of arguing their side, it seems to me.
Well, I think that that's, you know, I'm here to, as an officer of this court I'm an officer of, I'm telling you what I think about the case. That's not the real problems with this case, though. The problem with this case is that they have no common law right any longer. It doesn't exist. That's the problem. To pursue for a jury trial or anything else. This court has already made that quite clear in the...
Dalko.
Well, it was not wrongly decided because the legislature has a right to abrogate the common law. It did in this case, Justice Gableman. It absolutely did. If it didn't abrogate the common law and the employee's right to bring a third-party claim is unfettered, then how can it be that an employee can't sue their employer? The whole act would be out.
Okay.
How can it be they can't sue a co-employee?
It's a different
provision, Counselor. I mean, it's a whole chapter 102. Right? I mean, there are a few things in there besides 102.29, and I'm most interested in the statutory interpretation. And opposing counsel focuses on the first sentence, which I can understand why, and he's talking about maintaining an action in tort. And if I understand him, he says that's a common law claim. If I understand you, you say no, after 102.29 it becomes a statutory claim. Is
right.
That where you guys differ?
Absolutely. It becomes a his claim is a statutory claim as well. After Chapter 102 got passed, his became a statutory claim.
What authority do you have for that? Let me ask, I'm sorry, as a premise. So you agree that there was a common law claim that could have been maintained if, in your opinion, it wasn't abrogated. Is that correct?
Right. If there was not abrogated.
If there was not abrogation.
Right.
And if there was a common law claim, under Article 1, Section 5, there would have been attendant to that claim the right to a civil jury trial. Is that
right.
correct?
against employer, employees, et cetera.
Okay. So you are putting your eggs in the basket of abrogation. Now, of that common law claim.
Right.
Okay. Now, there are numerous cases that stand for the premise that to abrogate the common law, the intent of the legislature must be clearly expressed, State versus Huebner. The legislature will not be held to have intended to abrogate the common law where it is not clearly expressly referenced or stated. Cop versus National Enamel, and the cases go on. So show me, if you will, where you get the, as Huebner would say, the clear expression of legislative intent to abrogate.
It's in the chapter. They can't sue employees. They can't sue employers. They have to, if they had a clear right, a common law right that has not been changed at all, how can the legislature dictate how they're going to distribute the money? How can they say also that the employer has an equal voice, the same right as the employee has? How can that exist? It cannot exist. The law, when an employee enters into an employment situation, the Chapter 102 is part and parcel of that, as this court has stated in Berkeley.
Are you any relation to Edward Ryan, who used to be a justice on this court?
I was asking. I was looking at him. I'm saying, hey, okay,
he's lion of the law. You look a bit like him. As recently, the two of the main cases you folks are discussing here is the Dull case and the Bergen case, right? And Bergen talks about the employee having a common law right, as distinguished from the employer, which has only a statutory right. So you've got, and Bergen I just picked because it's the one of the main cases you're talking about, early 1950s, but I can pull a number, 1936, Employer Mutual Liability Insurance Company versus Ickes says the same thing. And there are a number of cases. So where is the authority that you're relying on that says the legislature abrogated the common law right in 1911.
Last paragraph of Bergen states, consequently, the trial court did not err in construing 102.29 stats as it did. Either looking at the cause of action in question as a statutory one and governed by Bentley versus Davidson, or as one protected against the involuntary infringement by state and federal constitutions, but waived by the voluntary act of the employer and employee in entering into their contract of employment, the court, by reason of that section, had full power to order such procedure, and under the circumstances of this case, was not guilty of any abuse of discretion in ordering Liberty Mutual to accept the offer of settlement. Bergen was not limited, and I understand what you're saying, Justice Bradley, but it made sure that it did not limit its opinion to the employer simply having a statutory right and the employee having a common law right. But my point is that the fact that it's abrogated cannot be more abundantly clear other than them saying that we abrogated it. They abrogated it when they passed the statute.
In 1911. What about 1913 when they changed the statute? And in 1913, the change was this. A couple of changes. But it goes to your question of waiver, which is kind of tantamount to your abrogation issue a little bit, or akin to it. And in 1913, the legislature says the making of a, in the statute that they amended, the making of a claim by an employee against a third party for damages by reason of an accident covered by sections 293-91, which is now the 102, inclusive, shall operate as a waiver of any claim for compensation against the employer. So in 1913, 2 years after workers' comp was passed in this state, they changed the statute to specifically indicate
hey, if you want to go ahead with your third party, you can, but that shall expressly states it shall operate as a waiver of any claim for compensation against the employer. In view of that legislative history, if I read it correctly and if it says what it says here, how can you maintain that in 1911 it was abrogated?
Because they stated who they could sue. And then they couldn't sue the employer and they couldn't sue the co-employee. And it was stopped in 1913 as the employee couldn't bring a claim if they accepted benefits because they were assigned to the employer.
No, we have the 1913 case, which is considered one of the seminal cases of this court, the Falk case in 1913, which passed on the constitutionality of the 1911 legislation, making Wisconsin the first state in the country to pass constitutionally valid workers' compensation law. But that case had nothing to do with the validity, as Justice Rogan second have hinted at, had nothing to do with the validity of a cause of action against a third party. It was all with regard to whether or not your cause of action as now changed by the workers' comp vis-a-vis your employer. You used to have a common law cause of action against your employer. Now you don't, and that's constitutional. But it had nothing to do with third party. And the Oliver case that you cite from 1937 saying you can't bring third party actions, that U.S. Supreme Court case, that had nothing to do with third party. It was all employer-employee. So help me.
Justice Bradley. The legislature has the right to define, abrogate entirely, or define the common law. As this court has ruled in the, is it Eicher case with regard to statutes of repose, wiping out completely a right to pursue a claim even before a person is wronged or injured. So if the legislature has that right to abrogate or define, and or define by abrogate. In this case, that's what they did. They defined it by saying you have a right to bring the claim. The employer has the same right, and the employer is going to have an equal voice, and this is how it's going to be distributed. And so there's no question about it. By passing this statute, the unfettered right under the common law to sue whoever is causing you a wrong no longer exists, just like you could say with the comparative negligence statute or any other statute.
That equal voice term didn't come in until 1949, I think. Do you know differently?
I do not. You know?
Counsel,
I don't believe. I don't know.
The employee has the right to bring a claim. The employer or insurer has the right to bring the claim. I agree with you. Those provisions are in here. When you were answering Justice Bradley, you said, When they take the benefits or they're given the benefits, then they assign their claim to the insurer.
That was back then, 1913. That was the law for quite a while. Only the employer could bring the claim, the third-party claim. That's my understanding. But that's no longer the case. Now the employer can bring it. It can bring it for pain and suffering to the employee, even if the employee doesn't join.
Okay. I'm back to my original question. Who drives the bus here? It seems like the employee can bring a claim, the employer or insurer can bring a claim, but where does it say that the insurer can control settlement?
The insurer cannot control the settlement. And that's the reason, it appears to me anyway, when I was preparing for this, is why we're here. What procedure should be used, really? What the legislature says, Justice Ziegler, is that in that statute, in 102.29, that when dispute, because you have two parties, each with a voice, you got a two-person corporation, board of directors, what have you. So they're going to have disputes. Who decides what the dispute is? And it says the trial court shall pass on whatever the dispute is in the case.
Okay, so what should be the test the trial court uses?
Trial court should use its discretion, in my opinion, to determine what is in the best interest of the claim.
Kind of like a minor settlement?
Yeah, it could be like a minor settlement, that's correct. It could be like, that's right. In a way, we're just talking about that in preparation. It's almost as though guardian ad litem momentarily for the claim. But the claim is a joint thing. Like this court said in the Thresherman's case, and I have this quote, it's designed to be the single injury opportunity to present claims arising from the It's designed to be the single opportunity, one single opportunity to present claims arising from the employee's injury. That it's like a corporate entity. It's like an estate almost. The claim is owned by two people, the employer and the employee, and that's how.
You have to stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm right at the cusp of whether I get something from my ears, so I apologize.
No, the acoustics in this room are very challenging. So,
thank you.
We're mindful of that.
I do appreciate it very much.
One of the things that I've been just, as this court would say, noodling over, is how does your argument play out when no lawsuit is filed, but there is a third-party settlement prior to the filing of a lawsuit? The statute specifically says that the third-party's distribution can be approved by the department. And in fact, the department has a WC-170 form for that. So how does that play out? Is it your position that before the plaintiff would even file a lawsuit, that the workers' comp insurance company can compel settlement?
I believe absolutely that it doesn't matter. It'd be I think it was your example of a minor child settlement.
Well, we look alike a little bit. That's right. Just so it wasn't someone else that you thought it came from. So you file this form, and then settlement and distribution of proceeds as stated above are approved in an administrative law judge. So even before they have access to the courthouse doors, Article 1, Section 9, or before they even file a lawsuit, you can compel settlement. Is that right?
Right. I think what you'd have to do is, because everybody has to sign off on the settlement. And so what we do in our office, and we have forms, the 10229 distribution forms. So you have to get the signatures, right?
But sure.
So if somebody doesn't want to sign it, then you're going to have to move to compel. And somebody's going to have to make that decision, has to pass on that, to use the language of the statute.
What's the last sentence in sub 1 mean, then? What does the last sentence in sub 1 mean, then?
Right. I believe that is kind of what I was getting at, is that of sub 1A, right? Is that what you said?
Read it out to us.
102.291, last sentence. A settlement of any third-party claim shall be void unless said settlement and the distribution of the proceeds thereof is approved by the court before whom the action is pending, and if no action is pending, then by a court of record or by the department.
Correct. I believe that's the indication. Somebody's got to pass on that. Somebody has to make a decision and sign off on it. And if there's a disagreement or whether it should be settled, then one person can object, or the other person can be and be the movant, or respond with the other person moving to compel. That's how I see it,
Mr. Ryan. Your opposing counsel indicated that Judge Welker didn't have sufficient information to make the determination he made. What's your response to that?
And with all respect to my esteemed colleague, that is not in any way my recollection. There are a number of documents, a number of depositions that the court looked at. The court looked at a reenactment of the accident using the same equipment at the same municipal parking lot with my expert, Robert Krenz, here in town. It looked at not one but two depositions of Mr. Wozniak, another engineer here in town. It looked at the depositions, excerpts from, I want to say, every one of the lay witnesses, Ron Adams, Mr. Adams' brother, Mr. Adams himself. There's just a variety of things that were looked at. The argument in summary judgment, and this is, if memory serves, Justice Crooks, I think it was nearly 2 hours in length. Judge Welker looked at this case very, very closely, and he came to the opinion that after looking at everything, there's a real serious chance that the plaintiff is going to get nothing out of it because he's going to lose on liability. Judge Welker didn't seem to me to do an outstanding job at looking at the case and could have come up with a different decision. Different judges can come up with different thoughts about it, but I think we proved pretty strongly that there was no real proof that the springs that we put on were too tight.
But you lost the motion.
We lost the motion, but with Judge Welker saying two things, Justice Bradley. That's true, I lost.
Yeah.
Judge Welker said two things. One is, it seems to me you're spitting into a pretty strong wind, as you read and we stated. And secondly, I'm going to be really interested in seeing what your expert, Mr. Greenwald, has to say with regard to that. So, thank you.
Oh, may I?
Yes, Justice Prosser has a question.
As I understand the argument, the League of Municipalities Insurance Company has a lot to gain if, in fact, the plaintiff goes forward and wins a tremendous big victory. They get everything that they paid out, and everything that they would have to pay out in the future would come from the cushion. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, so what I infer here is that the League of Municipalities Insurance Company has to have real doubts about the future of the claim.
Yes, Justice Prosser, and they expressed those doubts, and that's the reason that they wanted the settlement of $200,000.
Okay. But if they got $75,000 to $80,000 that's now in hand with the settlement offer, if they were assured of getting that from these folks, is there any reason why this suit shouldn't go forward so that all of the risk is on the other side?
Right. If they gave it up, if the plaintiffs gave it up and said, we'll guarantee no matter what else that you're going to get that, and that's what Judge Welker was questioning Mr. Greenwald about rather extensively in throwing different scenarios to test Mr. Greenwald's resolve, I might say. But that was one of them. And Mr. DeLurie, I believe, even offered, and I think that I believe this is in the hearing, offered to give up future. If Mr. Greenwald would give up a future claim, I think that they would just walk away entirely, any future claims that would come up. And Mr. Greenwald wasn't willing to do that. So, yes, I mean, they had an incentive, and they certainly believed that they had a lot of problems with that case.
The statute doesn't say that the employee has to give up any part of its claim in order to go ahead, right?
That's absolutely right, Chief Justice.
And if the employee wants to swell, but nothing in the statute compels that.
Right. That is correct.
Go ahead. I got the impression, again, there were no specific dollar amounts, I referred to this earlier, that the workers' comp carrier thought that they likely were going to be on, that they likely were going to have to be paying quite a bit of money in the future and because of the nature and extent of the injury. So the offer to settle and have the injured employee give up the right to have future payments for voc rehab, for permanent partial disability or temporary, you know, disability. I mean, that's given up an awful, that could be, in a big case, spinal cord injury, giving up an awfully lot for a little bit here. I don't think anyone would run to that one.
I think that was brought up to show that Mr. Greenwald's, to challenge Mr. Greenwald's opinion about how serious he was that he was going to actually persevere on this case. So that was the issue. And, okay, I have no more time.
I just want to clarify one thing. There was a lot of questioning about why the employee would just automatically always go ahead, even though it doesn't appear there's any downside. And you, if I understood your beginning of the argument, I mean, this is, to use the vernacular, does the employee have any skin in the game? To use the vernacular. And your response was the same as opposing counsel, namely the skin in the game is that the employee has by statute a right to sue third parties for a lot of damages that are not compensated by workers' comp. And so it's this potential of, just to use a number used here, $3 million that is being lost if the court forces a settlement. That's the skin in the game.
Well, that's part of the skin in the game. The other part is how much they have to pay in costs. I don't know what the relationship is between.
That's Mr. right. And so, which is the one I made. And, okay.
Right. But then the other side is obviously whether they get nothing. Thank you,
counsel. Mr. Greenwald.
Justices, again, I thank you for your intense questioning of both counsel. But I do want to make several comments in rebuttal. Opposing counsel said, and he quoted from part of the Bergen case,
counsel, what you're looking for, that there is one point that I would like to afford you the opportunity to rebut your opposing counsel's argument. And that runs to the idea that if we accept and apply the principles of Bergen involvement to this instance, why isn't it a matter for the sound discretion of our trial counsel?
What is the discretion of the... In this case, my position, as I set out in my briefs, the court did not exercise his sound discretion. He simply came to a conclusion. His decision...
I thought your opposing counsel mentioned that the summary judgment motion lasted 2 hours, did I hear? And he enumerated different documents and pieces of evidence and even just...
They submitted material, took out portions of depositions, took out portions of real. They didn't show any tape. They didn't provide any tape. Just to say, look, you can't prove anything. You can't prove this. You can't prove that. We have immunity, et cetera. And the court found that, no, Mr. Greenwald does have enough.
Thank you for answering my question. I asked the wrong question because I kind of Do you agree that if we accept and apply the principles of Burford and Dauphin in this matter, that the question before us is really whether the trial court exercised its sound discretion?
Oh. No. That is one issue. But there are issues of what were we allowed to present for the court to make a resolution.
So doesn't that run to your argument, which you started making in response to my second most previous question, which was the trial court here did not exercise discretion because the trial court did not make sufficient evidence. But I don't understand how that reflects the idea that under
Burgrin does not authorize the trial court to compel the settlement.
What kind of procedure would you like us to set forth for the trial court to use in future cases? Should it be treated like a minor settlement? What? How? That's really, I think, part of why this case is here, to try to help.
If you're going to have a hearing to resolve a dispute, you ought to at least begin with the common description of what is it that the parties are claiming? What is it that the parties are denying? Produce evidence according to a burden of proof. Even in a minor settlement approval, you have to present evidence.
So do you think
the judge
that's
just
a
doesn't
procedure?
Say, well, nilly-nilly. The judge asked the guardian ad litem to do an investigation. He asked the guardian ad litem to present materials.
Right, that's what I'm asking. Give us the procedure.
That's approval of a settlement. Here we're talking about the resolution of a dispute. We're not talking about approval of something everybody agrees to. We're talking about the resolution of a dispute between the parties.
So it'd be like minor settlement plus.
It's not a minor settlement.
Plus more.
Minor settlement is where everybody comes in and agrees to things. This is not a minor settlement. This is a dispute.
All right. Do you want...
What's the procedure?
Define what the dispute is. What is the dispute?
Dispute is that A wants to settle...
Define the basis of your side of the dispute. Advise the other side of the basis of your side of the dispute. Then meet the burden of proof in support of your position.
Well, what is
and then present evidence
what's
in
the
support
standard?
Of that burden of proof.
Your opposing counsel said the standing is what's in the best interest of the employee, if I understood it.
I thought you said of the settlement.
Of the settlement. Even Delka said the question is what's in the best interest of the employee.
That's what I just said.
That's what Delka said, yes,
okay.
Judge.
All right, but if that's not the right, correct question or correct standard, the point is that there has to be a standard. How are you going to judge this settlement? On what basis?
Yes.
You can judge it on the basis of the comparative interests of the employee and employer, or in the best interest of the employee who by statute has the right. Okay. Then shall we put, want me, I'm the employee, you want me to put on evidence as to, with my experts to indicate causation and my experts to indicate permanent disability on the spinal cord? Is that what you want? I mean, do you want to run a mini trial is another way of asking you?
I think that we should be allowed to present witnesses in support of our position as to the strength of our case. And I don't think it's just done by somebody giving an opinion.
Strength of the case, meaning what you would prove at a full trial on your tort claim.
The difficulty in this case is they didn't identify what was the weakness of our case that compelled the settlement. That's why I say, identify your position, and then the other side can respond to that position. Here, Judge Walker said, the statute doesn't do me anything. I don't know what to do.
So is it done through an offer of proof? If we went to trial, we would have these witnesses who would testify as follows, and then the other side would say, if we went to trial, we would have witnesses who would testify as follows, and then here's the settlement we propose, and then the judge concludes whether or not that's reasonable under the circumstances considering.
I'd present the witnesses.
Okay, so like the chief suggested, have a mini trial?
I think the court has to have evidence before it to make a decision.
That's what I'm just asking. I'm trying to set forth what is the procedure. What does the judge do?
I would present, with respect to those issues that they say that my case is lacking, I would present evidence to demonstrate that I have a strong position on those points. And I would present the witnesses that I would present at the trial to demonstrate that. I would present my evidence. Because the question is whether or not, the question was whether or not I had adequate evidence.
I'd like to go back to the colloquy between you and the Chief Justice, where I interjected myself erroneously, as it turns out. I thought I heard your opposing counsel say settlement, and I thought he was using shorthand at that time. The circuit court judge, the trial court judge, in the exercise of its sound discretion, weighing the competing interests,
there is no standard. That's the problem. I think the standard should be, as suggested by Delka, what is in the best interest of the employee, of the person that's being compelled to accept the settlement? What is in his best interest? That is the standard. I believe that should be the standard. Can I?
Just for clarity, your position is that there should be, your first position is, there should be no hearing at all here because a court isn't authorized to compel an injured party to settle the case. That's your first argument, is I read your brief. And then you don't, if there's no authority to do it, you don't get to, so what should the hearing be to, for the court to decide? Am I correct or incorrectly reading your brief?
100% correct.
Okay. I thought so. Thank you.
If I could just make one point. I know my time is up. Bergeron did not say that an employee who has a common law right can be compelled to accept a settlement. Said just the opposite. I'm quoting from the decision. It is apparent that this provision...
Just a minute, counsel.
Where are you?
You're at page what? You're at page, I think, 482, right?
482, 483, yes. It's in my brief. But the court says, it is apparent that this provision, being able to compel the employer to accept the settlement, in the light of the circumstances attending its application, namely, it is only applicable to a situation where the cause of action which is being prosecuted is of statutory origin as opposed to one which owes its existence to the common law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Our claim here is one based upon the common law. There has never been an abrogation of that common law. I've covered that through my reply brief. My time is up. If you have any questions about that point, or any other questions, Your Honors, I'll be happy to answer them at this time.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justices.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greenwald and Mr. Ryan. We've had over the years numerous workers' comp cases, and this one presents yet another issue that we didn't handle in directly in Bergeron, but the question is whether the Court of Appeals did in Dalka and what the effect of Bergeron and Dalka are here. And that concludes our argument in 12AP 580, Adams versus Northland Equipment Company. The court will meet in closed conference at 2 p.m. Thank you.